Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So I'm Josephine Ensign. I'm here at Jack Straw Cultural Center. It's the 12th of April, 2024, and I'm here with Ginger, is it Siegel? Is that
Siegel,
how you pronounce
yeah.
it? Siegel. And Ginger, tell me what led you to the work that you have done, that you continue to do.
Sure. So I my first encounter with housing challenges was when I was in college. And the college that I went to, the university that I went to, was systematically buying up housing in the neighborhood for staff. And they were converting that housing from the tenants that were currently living there to their staff, even to the point of if they had lower – they were offering housing to staff above a certain grade. So if there were people that lived in the housing that they bought below that grade – that worked for the university already, they were even evicting those people in order to make space for the higher grade employees. And so my first exposure to sort of housing scarcity and unfairness in housing policy was at that university where I saw, lower income people being moved out to make way for higher income people.
Right.
Yeah. So then that was in the mid-1980s, and I moved out here in 1987, and I started working for the Tenants Union. I was a tenant organizer in the late 80s and early 90s. So that was – homelessness was pretty different then. It was sort of at the beginning of modern homelessness. The phenomenon – that was leading to homelessness, especially for single adults, of emptying out these cheaper SRO buildings.
And SRO, a lot of people know it, but yeah.
Yeah, single room occupancy. So a lot of low-income single people in the United States were housed in SRO buildings, single room occupancy buildings, also sometimes called apartment hotels. So these were buildings where you had a single room usually with a sink. The code usually required a sink to be in the room. And then the restroom was down the hall. So there was a certain number of units for each restroom. And then the kitchen facilities were even less. In some buildings, there were only, a couple of kitchens for multiple floors. So that was a very, very common type of housing across the United States. And that type of housing was wiped out in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And that is a huge contributor to homelessness for single adults. There was a similar form of housing, rooming houses, in the neighborhoods that was housing families in sort of a somewhat similar shared environment. which had the same, you know, went the same way as far as, you know, it being eliminated and contributing to homelessness. I was a little less in touch with that because I was working mostly with single adults that were living in these SRO buildings.
And can you speak a little bit, as I think some people know, but not, you know, not enough people know, what the pressures were then to, not just in the Seattle area, but across the country, as you say, for the closure of the SROs?
So there were some of them, I think, were good pressures. They were about health and safety. A lot of buildings in Seattle were closed prior to the 1980s. They were closed in the 1970s because of fire code updates. Mm-hmm. So some of it was health and safety, fire code, and you know, other sort of basic decency standards of light, ventilation. But a lot of those, so there were code changes that some of which were true safety, but some of them were aesthetic. You know, this idea that people needed more space, this idea that it wasn't decent to live in a very small space or wasn't decent to share bathrooms or kitchens. So I do want to talk a little bit more about that because I think that's been very damaging, and that's been sort of, I don't know, it has to do with like American culture. But then also there was just development pressure that downtown property values went way up. And so these buildings that historically had been used as apartment hotels, many had not been maintained well. So they cost a lot to update. It became economically advantageous for the owners to instead sell them to, you know, high-rise developers or other downtown developers. So those buildings were either warehoused for future development, and so they were closed because it was cheaper to keep them closed rather than, you know, keep them habitable, or, you know, they were developed at the time.
And a lot of that in Seattle, I imagine, was Pioneer Square area and along First.
Well, certainly downtown, the downtown core from Denny to through Pioneer Square. Okay. But then it also bled out. I mean, there were bled out is not a great term. It also, you know, there was sprawl around downtown. Mm-hmm. First Hill, Capitol Hill, Soto, Georgetown. And the neighborhoods, too, many of the old, you know, the old commercial centers in the neighborhood, some of those had SRO buildings in them. But the bulk was downtown and in the surrounding communities, Lower Queen Anne. Those areas all had a lot of SRO housing.
Okay. So do you want to talk about the pressures in terms of, like, the American ideal of a bathroom and a kitchen?
Yes. So a lot of, you know, we think of codes as being safety-based, and a lot of codes are safety-based, or other public policy. Like right now, there's a lot of improvement of the energy code because of climate change. So those are, you know, real important policy goals that are being met with code changes, make people safer and make our society produce less, you know, carbon emissions. But a lot of codes have been driven not by policy, but by a sort of thought of the way people should live. Mm-hmm. And you see it with sort of the racist policies of redlining, the classist policies around zoning, where multifamily zoning was in areas with less amenities. But you also see it in the elimination of small housing units, that there was this idea, and it still is prevalent today, that it's just not right for people to live in units that are less than 200 square feet, for example, which is very small. But it's a lot better than being in a car or a tent.
Yeah, so especially during the pandemic or during other kinds of things, anytime.
Yeah. Really. Yeah, so there's really no science behind that view that very small units are unhealthy in some manner.
And probably that has contributed to the pushback about even like tiny house villages, the tiny houses are.
Yeah, I mean, tiny house, yes, some of those tiny houses are not code compliant. So I'm not, you know, I think there are some real important issues to think through, you know, even for advocates about tiny houses. Do we want sort of a two-level society where some codes apply for some people but the codes don't apply for others? Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's some things that we need to think through about that. But code-compliant tiny houses, meaning that they're conditioned They are just as safe as, you know, anything else. They're just small houses. They're on permanent foundations. You know, they have legal egress. They have legal access to, you know, cooking and hygiene. Those, I think, have the same issues of this sort of American concept of what's okay rather than what's truly safe for people.
And having – expanding our affordable housing stock again.
Yeah. I mean, it is tricky because private developers will take advantage of any leniency in the code that there is. So you it's not like – you know, if you say small units are okay, that people aren't going to make a lot of money on small units. Mm-hmm. So, it's not the private market. What small units does is it allows the private market to get a little deeper into affordability. But it's not doesn't mean that developers aren't taking advantage of those leniencies.
Yes, of course. Business.
Yes.
Bottom
right.
line. So you started working with the tenants union.
Yeah,
can
so
you tell me more
the,
about that?
Sure. So I worked for the tenants union in, like I said, the late 80s and early 90s. And at that time, there were still a lot of SRO buildings. I worked with a lot of SRO tenants. And that demographic that lived in those buildings today are mostly homeless, or they live in subsidized housing, government-supported housing. There was no replacement for that type of housing. So as it was lost, people either could find a government-funded apartment unit or they ended up on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of people that were I'm not a healthcare person, but I think probably had some mental illness, some substance use disorder, some level of disability,
mm-hmm.
but they also had some stability and had some access to income. They worked marginally or were on Social Security, and there was sort of a place for them that worked.
Mm-hmm.
They could afford housing. You know, maybe it was taking 50% of their income, but that worked for them, and they were inside, and many people lived in those buildings for years.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with people that lived in those buildings for 20, 30 years, and that was not uncommon. That was not a unique situation. They were not those buildings were not necessarily transient. So that population had nowhere to go, and they ended up largely homeless. And I imagine that, you know, from a health perspective, just surmising, I would imagine a lot of people's challenges got a lot worse when they underwent the stress of homelessness.
Of course. Yes. It's a huge – just homelessness itself, you know, is a major trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So – and during that time, the rise of new homelessness and the tenants that you were working with and I know, you know, like you say, you weren't a healthcare person, but did you hear from them? Like, were you working with some people that had just been deinstitutionalized, like released from Northern or Western
no,
State?
Not to my knowledge. Substance abuse was a little bit more prominent to me, maybe because I could recognize it
mm-hmm.
more.
And substances being alcohol.
Definitely alcohol. God. I don't know about other drugs, but at that time, there was a lot of drinking
mm-hmm.
in those buildings that I saw. And I could see that people had problems with drinking. It was not just, you know, casual drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there was more that I didn't see. I didn't know what to look for. Nor did I care.
It wasn't your role.
It wasn't my role. My role was to help them sort of negotiate a solution to their
mm-hmm.
housing challenge, which was often a relocation package. And so I did help, you know, a lot of tenants, groups of tenants get relocation packages. And some of those, you know, went and took the money that they got and stabilized somewhere else. And some of those blew the money quickly and some of those blew the money slowly, or not blew it, but just the money didn't last that long in truth.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so what how did your kind of role and involvement around housing, low-income housing, evolve
since
from
then,
there?
Yeah. So I got very involved in Operation Homestead, which
mm-hmm.
you may have heard from some of your other interviewees. So we were a group that tried to stop abandonment and tried to reuse existing buildings or reopen existing buildings. We were sort of naive. We thought the solution was, you know, stop this, move away from these apartment hotels, keep them, reopen them, rehab them. That would, you know, solve homelessness because that's where it was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took over buildings and we made quite a stink. We made quite a ruckus. We were on the front of the newspaper. And we didn't know because we were just sort of a ragtag group of activists. But like if you look at the evolution of state policy, there's a very clear connection to Operation Homestead's building takeovers and the Displacement Coalition's activism work and the creation of the State Housing Trust Fund and the funding of the State Housing Trust Fund is a very direct link.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that these activist groups were getting on the cover of the newspaper every day and the advocates in Olympia were making use of that public pressure and created the State Housing Trust Fund.
Right. Yeah, using media
yes.
as part of the advocacy three-pronged stool that Nancy Amodé talks about.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So I did that. That was I feel really good about that work. That was done in conjunction with homeless people. So there was a very significant community organizing
mm-hmm.
component to that work. The difference between homeless people and non-homeless people inside Operation Homestead was more or less seamless. We did some, I think, good work and
mm-hmm.
developed important relationships and, played a good role at that time. That lasted several years and sort of dissipated, probably mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, you know, some of us, like myself, kind of went on to, you know, have families and have less kind of room for that type of activism. But then the sort of the rent increase people came later,
mm-hmm.
like the Judy Nicastro crowd came later and sort of took on that mantle of that very public activism to get policy change.
And then I guess also there was at least some overlap, probably not just time-wise, but with that activism that you were involved with the creation of ShareWheel.
Oh, so Share is the same era. So Share, you know, there were some personalities that I think got in the way a little bit of, you know, sort of the whole community working, you know, more in concert. But so Share was led by Scott Morrow, who
mm-hmm.
you probably interviewed and
right.
I'm
well,
sure know about.
I unfortunately didn't before he died,
uh-huh.
but I do know and do know him.
Sure. So he was a colleague of mine at the Tenants Union,
mm-hmm.
and he was working more with churches. He was very interested in the role of churches, I think for personal reasons. But also he saw it as like the key organizing tool. He thought if you went to congregations and you made a link between congregations and homeless people, like a personal link, like
mm-hmm.
congregations would help a group of homeless people, that would politicize the congregation to work in support of policy change for that would fight homelessness. So that was the sort of kernel.
Mm-hmm.
But he did he was doing weekly fasts when I knew him in the early years in the late 80s. Like he was, he had discussion circles with religious leaders, with Christian leaders. So it was a very, it wasn't a casual concept. It was a very deep approach.
Mm-hmm.
But the route he went was more in creating shelters that were self-managed. So they were, you know, bringing homeless people up through sort of a leadership system, a leadership,
mm-hmm.
a way for people to develop leadership skills. And he, you know, was a difficult person. So there was a lot of friction at times between him and Operation Homestead, which was, you know, taking over these buildings and also was including homeless people. But it was, you know, it was sort of a different approach. And so there was at times friction. But they were moving in parallel.
Right. And then also, from what I understand of the history of especially Tent City 3 or the other variations of Tent City, of speaking of codes, of that faith-based organizations, you know, especially churches with buildings and owning land and buildings, that they could shelter in a different way than other places that weren't faith-based.
Right. Yeah, I don't know as much about that history. I know a little bit about it, but churches have always played a really important role in the safety net, and they play a huge role in the homeless safety net, as you know, both for food and for shelter, and to, I guess, some extent politically as well, by getting the word out about policy.
Right. So then we're up to when you were raising a family. And so what sorts of things were you involved in?
Yeah,
then?
So I worked for Lehigh. So I had been doing Operation Homestead, and I had been at the tenant union, so I had this sort of bank of skills and experience around community organizing. And they had saved the Orion Court, which was one of Operation Homestead's buildings, and they had saved some of the complexes that were at risk that I had worked with at the tenants union. And so they wanted to incorporate self-managed housing into their model. They were new at the time. They were just being created. They were created for the Aloha Inn and then later for the Orion Court, or brought in the Orion Court soon after. And so they hired me to come up with a model of self-managed housing. And I did that for them for several years, and that was cool because it was super empowering for the residents. Mm-hmm. They were really – they took their responsibilities of creating policy and then implementing the policy for how their complexes were run, you know, who to let in, when to evict people, what kind of rules to enforce, how to enforce those rules. They took those responsibilities very seriously, and, you know, a lot of people learned a lot about leadership. But it was really time-consuming way of operating housing, and it became clear that it was just not efficient use of resources to have community organizers working with, you know, tenant complexes. If you know anything about condos, you know, condos are famous for the homeowners association being impossible.
Yes.
It was sort of like that, but with,
a different socioeconomic strata.
Right, exactly. So it was extremely time-consuming.
And had its own unfortunate built-in biases and prejudices. And
yeah, although, you know, I got to say, I almost never saw that. I saw people be really careful with their responsibility.
Nice.
But it was not a way you could operate a large amount of housing.
Wasn't really sustainable, and
it was not sustainable.
Scalable. Right?
That's
so what did you draw on? I mean, I know... a child, kind of the late 60s. But what did you draw on yourself in terms of like these empowerment, self-managed models?
Well, I think, you know, it's community organizing 101.
Mm-hmm.
It's listening, it's believing that all people can contribute and finding the right place for them to contribute. It's supporting people. I mean, I think the real key is to understand that your role is to support others. Your role is not to lead yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what community organizers sometimes get wrong. Community organizers end up in the leadership position instead of in the supporting of the people that they're working with.
The human egos.
The human egos.
Power dynamics, yeah.
Yeah, right. So I don't think there's anything different in this type of organizing than any other type of organizing. There's a group of people that is being treated in some disrespectful manner, and you're helping them come up with a strategy that they can implement to change that.
Right. So it sounds like maybe going back to your university experience, with the university being a bully and contributing to homelessness, which, of course, University of Washington right here has rightly been accused of over the years. So I assume you got some on-the-ground mentoring and experience in community organizing there?
Not really. I was much more of a just a – witness there.
I gotcha.
Okay. I wasn't really involved, or I wasn't significantly involved. No, I learned here. I learned largely from Scott Morrow, actually, community organizer.
Right, right.
And, you know, that's where I was, introduced to Saul Alinsky's books and mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then by doing and by seeing the sort of beauty and skills of people.
Right.
That people have just – people are real gems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like every person, you know, just people have so much to contribute and so much in them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard even like a physician at Harborview calling people gold coins.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to remember that
with
everybody, no matter what their walk of life.
Right.
So tell me kind of how you evolved into the and describe some of the work that you're doing today.
Yeah, so I have four kids, and it was hard to keep a really high workload going for when my kids were small. So I worked, I stayed at Lehigh, and then I went off and I did policy work for
mm-hmm.
a few years. I was the director of the Housing Alliance, which is the Housing Network, which is the precursor to the current Housing Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did federal and state policy. Because I knew that policy was where the real act was. Like,
mm-hmm.
if you really wanted to change the situation for people, a lot of people, policy was the place to be. And that is true. It's totally true. But policy wasn't the right place for me. So I did that for a while, and I learned a lot about federal policy, and I learned a lot about state policy. But policy advocacy is really different than community organizing.
So describe that a little bit more.
Well, policy advocacy is, it's got this wonk side of it, right? You got to get into the, you have to understand the policy itself. You have to understand how to read policy and how to not do damage by accident, which happens with policy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's, sort of getting a bunch of nonprofit leaders to step in at the key time to push the policy. It's just very different than working with disenfranchised people
mm-hmm.
and people that don't have a voice. Instead, you're sort of directing people that already have a voice to use their voice in certain key times.
Right.
It's really it's very different sort of work.
And different timeline. Don't see the immediate results.
Yes, that's true.
You have to kind of do the long game.
It is. Policy is definitely the long game, although it is the important game.
Yeah.
So
you decided that wasn't really where your skill set was.
Yeah, so I actually went back to Lehigh, and then my third kid was born, and it was just too much. And so I left, and I put out my own shingle for a while, and I just picked up contract work. And then I ended up working for a Spokane-based low-income housing developer.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 16 years, and that was great. And that's where I learned housing development, and that's what I still do. I do housing development. So I develop affordable housing, mostly for special needs populations, but not exclusively. And I do that all over the state. And I work with a lot of really lovely people.
Nice.
And I'm working on a shelter in Walla Walla. I'm working on a project for people with mental illness in Pacific County, super rural. I'm working on a project for the Tulalip tribes.
Nice.
I'm more sort of technical at this point. Like, I help them put these projects together, which are very overly complicated, and you really need this very particular skill set to know these federal and state programs to be able to put the packages together. So it's not so much advocacy anymore.
It's the nuts and bolts of getting this on the ground.
Right, exactly. I mean, I dabble in policy here and there. I'll sit on committees and I'll share my two cents,
mm-hmm.
but my work is now putting these projects together. That's what I do for a living.
So, any interface with any of the Apple Health and Homes projects?
Yes, I do a lot of. I'm doing a lot of that right now because it's new and people mm-hmm. are having trouble figuring out how to work.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. So I'm working with several mental health agencies that are having a lot of trouble figuring out how to work with Apple Health and Homes. Mm-hmm. So there are some policy issues. There are some really important policy issues around coordinated entry, I think, and around using basically low service, you know, even the full-on PSH to replace institutions. Permanent supportive housing. Yeah. Which is a term that is not clear, you know.
Right. Like, how permanent and how supportive.
Right, exactly.
How housing.
Yes, right, exactly. But sort of using it as a replacement for institutions, mm-hmm. there's some important conversations that need to happen there. Mm-hmm.
And going back to almost an SRO, sort of a, not exactly, but a lot of people.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah, talk about that of like, we got rid of SROs and, you know, and some of these permanent supportive housing first, feel like SROs
yes.
in some ways.
Yeah, So the issues that I'm having or that my clients are having mm-hmm. is that they are feeling forced to take people they cannot handle. Mm-hmm. And then they feel like that puts the other people in their complexes mm-hmm. in jeopardy.
Well, it does, and the staff.
Yeah.
I've heard that a lot from people.
Right. So I have two behavioral health – or I have one behavioral health client, like a behavioral health organization. That's what they do, that refuses – to meet the requirements of Apple Health and Homes because it will force them to take people straight out of institutions that they feel like they do not have the – they can't do that well mm-hmm. and safely for the other people in their complex.
Mm-hmm.
So it's – you know, I'm basically a voyeur because I don't really know this world. I don't know the world of Medicaid. I don't know, you know, the – different kind of service packages,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I do see in my work and also in my personal life the connections I have, you know, my husband and I have with people that live in permanent supportive housing mm-hmm. projects, that it's not all rosy.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it's not the – so I think there was this sort of like almost evangelical mm-hmm. pushing of permanent supportive housing. And I really think it's time for us to take some steps back and say, let's do an honest evaluation of whether this is a good idea.
Right. Well, and I've heard from a lot of people that – and I had a little tiny drop in the bucket mm-hmm. of the policy work that you know, Representative Frank Chopp and Nicole Macri did for Apple Health and Homes and all of the different systems of, mm-hmm. you know, Medicaid, you know, Apple Health, and then all of these different, mm-hmm. you know, agencies having to weigh in. But that I hear a lot from people around Housing First, permanent supportive housing, is, you know, because you have the housing people and then mm-hmm. you have the supportive services mm-hmm. that are usually different agencies
often,
running
yeah.
it. And that coordination doesn't always work well,
mm-hmm.
and the staffing challenges, the burnout, and just, yeah, how much supportive services people...
Some people need really...
That are high needs or and who are most likely going to need for the rest of their lives. So what, mm-hmm. As a society, what do we do?
Yes, right. I think there's some really important analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And thought that's needed before we just keep marching, because I'm not sure we're marching completely in the right direction.
Well, and then also, and it sounds like from what, you know, because you're working across the state,
mm-hmm.
Including like smaller rural areas and mm-hmm. tribal lands and everything that of not that whole thing about wanting to ship people out.
Yeah,
the Greyhound bus thing. We don't want to have this in our area.
Right.
We'd like to ship them all to Seattle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot to be done there, and there's a lot about messaging. There's a lot about substance. And I guess the other, just one other comment on it is that permanent supportive housing was such a major push in the funding world and in the jurisdictions really pushed for it and HUD really pushed for it. There were some champions as far as, you know, like DSC and mm-hmm. Catholic Charities. And it diverted a ton of resources. So there was like no resources for anybody else for a long time. So there were these, there was this big group of people that were not appropriate for permanent supportive housing, but had no other housing options. They did not have an income that was sufficient to afford market rate housing. And there was almost no resources for that group for a long time. So I think there's also, we have to be really careful that we don't say one group of people is more important than another group of people. I think advocates have to always have the message that we need to have a system that takes care of the everybody. And we are, we as advocates will not say one group is more important than another group ever. Like, we shouldn't say singles are more important than families. We shouldn't say children are more important than adults. We shouldn't say
teens and aged,
right,
elderly,
exactly.
Homeless people,
right, or somebody who is disabled by mental illness is more important than, you know, somebody who works a minimum wage job. We, I think, have gotten into the trap of doing that prioritization, and I think we should refuse.
Well, and speaking of wonks, policy wonks, I mean, looking at it from an economic cost benefit, you know, the whole push to kind of label people as chronically homeless and that they're the costliest, right? They cost society the most because of the, you know, very high needs. And so that's, from what I understand, that the pressure to have more permanent supportive housing, thinking that that would take care of chronic homelessness. But
you mean that there was a financial argument that,
right?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely that, and I think, yeah, that's interesting. So there's, that's been a big argument, is that it's cheaper to put people in housing than to have the revolving emergency room door and the
carceral system.
Right, exactly. And high, you know, law enforcement and
State, the dwindling state mental health facilities like Western State.
Right. So that has been a trap, I guess.
So what are you excited about? What are you hopeful about?
Well, I think that actually looking at people's health conditions and having that more prominent in how we view what people need and what government should pay for, I think that's very positive. I think seeing the both the connection between people's health and their housing, but also seeing having a clinical approach towards severe mental illness and substance use disorder, and less blaming, less kind of like, these are the people that couldn't get their act together. These are the people that were deficient in some way. I think that's very positive, having a more medical approach, because also, like, I think medicine is a little better at being, you know, sort of colorblind or less discrimination to say, you know, it's people either have this condition or they don't. Whereas, you know, there was a lot of judgment against, you know, people's moral fiber, you know, when these problems were not seen as medical problems. So I think that's positive.
So development in our understanding of especially addictions
and also
mental illness.
Yeah, behavioral health.
Right.
I think that's positive. Yeah.
Right.
What are, you know, I think the generosity, positive, oh, so the generosity of King County and Seattle residents in passing the levies. Our state has been very, I think, progressive and generous. Those are positive. You know, I think the missing party is the federal government. The federal government backing out of housing, a huge impact on homelessness, huge contributor, probably the primary contributor to homelessness is the federal government not supporting housing.
Starting in the 80s, right?
Starting with the Reagan administration. Yeah, just a massive, you know, if you look at the HUD funding levels, there's this cliff when in the Reagan years, and we have just built back up, but it's taken, you know, 40 years, and even so, we're still way below where we were. So that's just a massive. There's a fundamental economic problem where our economy does not produce housing for a huge portion of the population, And none of the policy debates are dealing with that squarely. So we are basically the problem. The economic forces that are causing the problem are making the problem worse. And our strategies are very small compared to those economic forces. So another problem with the advocacy community is we have said we're going to solve this too many times, but we never could solve it because those economic forces were always much stronger than our strategies. So we trapped ourselves into this idea of like, so much money has been spent, and what have you done with it? Mm-hmm. What have you done with all that money?
Or the permanent supportive housing, Housing First, it hasn't worked.
Yeah,
I mean, even with the problems, it actually has worked, but the number, sheer number of people coming into that is we can't keep up.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, yes, we have done wonderful things with that money. Many people's lives have changed with that money, but we have not been able to stop new people from coming into the system.
So hopefulness and also also more work to do for all of us.
A lot more work, yeah.
At the federal level, too.
I think the federal level is really like, I don't know why cities like Seattle are not like laser focused on organizing with their peer jurisdictions around the country to try to get the federal government off the dime. Because that is where that's the missing piece.
Right. Well, here's hoping.
Yes.
And we're in an election year.
Yes, we'll see.
We'll see. Well, Ginger, I want to thank you for taking time. I've heard, you know, from other people just little bits of what in some of the organizations and everything that you have been involved with. So thank you for your previous work and also for your current work and going forward. I appreciate it.
Sure. And thank you for documenting it.
All right.
I don't think anybody else is documenting it. It's good.
I don't think so. All right. Thanks.
Great.